from the Skinny D Media Archives.
This depiction is dangerous.
Come on, Enid.
I'm cutting it.
Good evening, this is Skinny E Media, presenting one of the greatest interviews that I can even think of. And we have here one of the co-writers behind Censor, Mr. Anthony Fletcher. Thank you for stopping on by with us.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Hey, more than welcome there. I know this has been quite a bumpy ride going through this production, everything with the pandemic, and then, you know, originally starting with the works, it's around 2018 and 2019. So, we definitely have many, many questions for you for this particular interview, and I'm happy to have you here. How do you do today?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I'm good. Dealing with the Southern Hemisphere winter, but apart from that, I'm absolutely fine. Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
We're happy to hear about that there. Unfortunately, we couldn't get Prana Bailey Bond with us for this particular interview. She was quite busy with other commitments she had to make, but we definitely got you on board to get a slightly different perspective on how you approach the film yourself. And the first question I wanted to ask is in regards to Nev Olgar's character, Enid, the inspiration for her. Was she more or less based on a particular person? Because for me, she reminded me a lot of like a Welsh teacher I had many, many years ago, quite mannered and subtle in her own sort of way. At least that's what I'm getting at.
To be honest, no, she wasn't based, she wasn't, her character, I mean, there's elements of her character which have to do with the censors, a couple of female censors themselves who we spoke to, but that they're only elements. She's not really based on anybody. You wouldn't say that she's based on anybody in particular. No, no. I mean, maybe there's a, in fact, I'm pretty sure in my head she isn't. And I don't think Prana had anybody. The other thing to note about that is, you know, she really evolved over the course of several years as a character. You know, like we had the idea of the person working in that office and what her attitude was towards the film she was watching. But you have to go through a long process to really get to know your characters. They don't leap out of you. So no Welsh teachers, no Welsh language, nothing of that. No, sorry.
All right, then. I wasn't saying it just for her, because I know she grew up in Cambridge. Just from my own perspective, because she definitely looked a lot like, this was back in primary, Miss Quentin was her name. I know she said that she usually had the character in mind to be male, but then they changed it to be female, which I'm actually quite happy with. It lends an element of, you wouldn't even expect it, because I know most of the BBFC staff at the time were men themselves.
I don't know. I mean, I know Enid had other names before, which I'm not going to disclose, but it's like the idea that she would be have been a man. I think we discarded that really early in the process. I mean, if that was, you know, that was not. I mean, you have to bear in mind, it's nearly 10 years we've been working on this project since we started to work on it. And I imagine Prana might have been thinking about it even before then. But I think pretty quickly we knew that the censor character was going to be female, not male. Yeah,
definitely. All right, I'm glad to get that out of the way for everyone who's watching. I probably should have said earlier on the interview myself was that I actually have visited the BBFC offices many years ago, back in June 2013. And Ian Mashir, maybe I shouldn't name his name, but I'm sure it may work there, maybe not. He was talking about how they view clips and the context and what ratings issues that were presented on board and how they have to comply with government regulations and also the guidelines that were put into place, which was at that time, 2009 to 2014, they do it in 5-year increments. So that was one of the greatest days of my life. And that is one of the reasons why I love this film, in particular, more so than any other film I saw this year. No offense to Forever Purge and Willy's Wonderland and Judas and the Black Messiah and Nomadland, but Censor holds a special place in my heart. And with that in mind, influence-wise, was outside of the giallo sort of material was Paul Schrader and films such as 8mm, Taxi Driver, and Hardcore in the background, in your mind?
I don't know. I mean, I think we had a very diverse kind of spectrum of films that we were interested in, and that we watched and we thought about. Obviously there are the video nasties and the giallo and you know, the more classical the horror kind of films. I think a film we should mention is definitely is Videodrome, which was a definite, you know, I think you could say that's a hands-on definite influence. We watched that, and you can see elements of Videodrome in Censor. I'm not going to tell you what they are, but you can see them. They're definitely there. But then, another film that we really watched and in some ways influenced us, which again is using video, was Caché, Hidden by Haneke. So, you're talking about, and then you go into the more obvious, Dario Argento and that kind of thing. So, there's a wide range of influences there. So it's hard to pin down which one. I think Schrader, not so much from my point of view, maybe from Pranos. I mean, we both watch stuff independently and then we compare notes. But I think that the Videodrome is the one that most I would pull out as being a really important reference point for us.
I would agree with that too. I know Videodrome is one of my favourite films from Cronenberg's catalogue. When I first saw it, I didn't quite appreciate that much, but over the years, I've seen it about 2, 3, or 4 times, and it definitely gets better, especially with the sort of knowing, I don't know if it's satire, but I would say it's sort of social commentary about media desensitization towards extreme violence and sexual content, pornography. That definitely keeps people at edge there, and the message still resonates even to this day, even if it's not so much evil, bad films that are going to corrupt your mind when you're tired.
I think the other thing about what Cronenberg does in that is he's really pushing the boundaries of what, of realism, of naturalism, trying to go beyond that. I mean, Cronenberg does that on a lot of levels. He's obviously done that. But, I think that's the cinematic language he uses as much as obviously the content has overlaps with Censor, but that idea of inanimate objects having a life and being breathing and pulsing and that kind of thing was really important for us. We don't use that much of it, but it's present and existed in the way we thought about where the film could get to and where it could go.
A good approach to come from it from there. There's many great films and titles definitely influenced Censor itself. Because I know there's a lot of use of in-film clips that were probably made by Prano and her team, Annika Summerson and herself. I know everyone likes to say,
hey, use a clip from Killer Killer, or a clip from maybe Solomon, I might be wrong. I'm doing the opening montage, so the context of what it is.
About the video, Nazi culture and Thatcherism. Which even leads me to another point in regards to the censorship and sort of social commentary. Maybe it's satire, I don't know. I didn't view it as a dark comedy, but have both of you seen This Film's Not Yet Rated or South Park Big Along When Uncut? Because from my perspective, censorship is not a topic that's openly discussed in cinema, not at least as I know of mainstream films. But This Film's Not Yet Rated in South Park, which is an adult cartoon that when I grew up, I couldn't watch. I was like 6 when that film came. I was like, oh, man. So this film holds a special place in that regard because it sort of taps in that sort of, you really want to see it, but you're not allowed to sort of element.
Yeah, I definitely, that whole illicit thing is really important. And, that's I think it was, we always have this double thing. I mean, video nasties are much more relevant and significant for Prano than they ever were for me, even though I grew up more in that era than she did. But I think that whole thing of when you're growing up and telling someone they're not allowed to watch a film makes you 17 million times more desperate to watch that film. That's the way it is. And that's a really interesting paradox and contradiction. So, and I think also there's something in there that the whole you know, British BBFC censorship, what they were trying to do was doomed. I mean, it was doomed, you know. They're like, you know, it was they were trying to hold back the tide, and there's something quite funny about that. We watch a lot of those films now from the 80s, and we find them funny. We don't find them shocking. We find them kind of ridiculous and absurd. And so, you know, like they kind of started fighting battles which they were always going to lose. And that's also interesting, you know. But then when you go back to the BBFC, which we did, you talked about, you visited there, and you see the notes, that they weren't stupid. They were really aware of the absurdity of a lot of what was going on. They're really kind of conscious of it. But at the same time, they did feel as though they had a moral responsibility for society, which is something that, you know, obviously in the film, Enid has very, very definitively as a, something that's important for her. She cares about the moral health of society. She's worried about it. So it's just that fascinating thing. Society's going to change. Like, if you censor films or not, they're going to change. You know, the history of censorship is generally a history of failure, I would say, you know.
Oh, yes, especially where you can see so many, what we would say, illicit titles, like you said, who rejected stuff on these, even YouTube and illegal torrenting websites, which you shouldn't check. You should buy a copy of Censor instead of pirate it. That's just saying that for the audience out there. Yeah, anything's pretty much open nowadays. I mean, you know, even someone when I was at university was trying to show me a clip of... there's not going to be any censorship. I'm not going to bleep anything out. A donkey getting fucked by a human.
Right.
Yes, and then a really graphic ISIS beheading as a means of, see, this is what these kind of people do. See, this is what I think. Now you even have that sort of dark web sort of thing that's going on right now with likes of people selling revenge porn and child pornography, which is completely illegal and horrifying to watch. So yeah, it's a really nasty way in many ways. If the censor can't be there or the film examiner, you're going to have to edit yourself. At least that's what I had to do. I even have to do it with my mother, and she's in her 50s and 60s. She can't even handle the level of violence that's in like an army.
Yeah, no, I completely understand that. I mean, it seems to me that there's two things at work here. One is if a crime is being committed in the process of filming something, then, you know, like the classic idea is of a snuff movie. Well, then the issue isn't so much whether you should censor it. It's a crime has been committed, you know. So I don't know. You get into very sort of complex territory, but I would say more generally that when people try to censor art in general, it just doesn't work. You know, it doesn't work. Sooner or later, the stuff gets out. You know.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah. It never really works. Well, I will say on my end, film censorship-wise, when you before you've done Censor and Nasty, the short film that preceded it,
yeah.
Did you see this film's not yet made or South Park, Big Along with Uncut as influences, or just like, those are the only two that really exist?
No, we didn't see those as influences. No, right. I don't think we did. No. I, and again, like I say, it's you know, like the approach is more. You know, it's not about a specific movie. You know, the specific movie that occurs is the fictional one that's in the film, which is called Don't Go in the Church. Yeah, that's what it's called. Like, I remember now. Yeah, Don't Go in the Church. So you know, like, you know, so it's specific movies that I mean, it's fascinating, the BBFC, looking at how they comment on Ken Russell movies, which is something that really intrigued me, you know, and the whole palaver around trying to edit the, I can't remember what the film's called, but
The Devils.
The Devils, that's the
one. Yeah, got cut like a...
You know, there's about a 300-page book written there in the, you know, like about, and the cuts and what can be cut and what can't be cut. So I think, you know, we weren't looking at particular films. We were looking at the general process of censorship rather than a particular process.
That's what I figured out myself as well. It's a holistic process. Could you cover also... the culture surrounding it as a means to escape from the real issues that are going on unemployment, closing of factories.
Exactly, yeah.
Falklands, whatever it might be. Just getting on to the next question as well. What was your first experience when you were growing up with film classification? Because you're probably of a generation that remembers when UAAA and X was around. I'm sure there was a sort of I want to see the X or AA film. My father was like that.
No, definitely. I mean, you know, that an X had a mystique which, you know, attracted one to want to watch it. I've got to be honest. I'm so old and it's so long ago that I can't remember specific films that would have been the ones that everyone had to watch right now. But, you know, yeah, obviously in putting that grading idea in, all it did was make people want to go and watch the one that they weren't supposed to watch. You know, I mean, again, it's a self-defeating exercise, really. And people found ways to watch films they weren't supposed to watch. Even then, before the internet, people would find ways to watch them. You know, like that was.
I knew someone got a copy of Clockwork Orange, and I believe Natural Born Killers. Well, they were in Los Angeles and they brought it all the way via customs to the United Kingdom when those two particular films were still unofficially banned in Britain. They didn't come out on video and DVD until like 1999, 2000. And I always caught in the corner of my eye, why is there this film that looks like Woody Harrelson with a gun? And I thought, that's the movie. I couldn't watch it growing up because I wasn't 18 at that time, but I definitely knew on the corner of my eye, it's that evil movie with the people that say, oh, it's going to encourage mass violence and mayhem and hysteria.
Clockwork Orange was, it was Kubrick himself who took it out of, so it's slightly different there. You know, he was the one who's banning his own film. You know, to think that Natural Born Killers was banned, it just seems absurd now. I mean, you can't, how can that be? I mean, it's as absurd as, you know, like D.H. Lawrence, you know, Lady Chatterley's Lover being, you know, you read it now, you're what was all the fuss about? But,
Only film I can think of that probably is deserving of being banned one way or another is probably like, I'm in public, so I have to be a bit careful about what I say. It's a certain film from Eastern Europe that came out 10 years ago, and it sounds a little like Cherubian. You can that particular title that was cut by 4 minutes. I don't want to see, you know, children in apples being buggered and stuff. I've seen that on Brass Eye. No,
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that because that's the film that Prano, I haven't seen it, but Prano mentions as the one that made her think, the first one that made her think maybe there's a case for censorship. I mean, that's the same film. She mentions that. I haven't seen it, so.
That's not too, so that way Uruguayan customs or police don't knock your door and say, ¿Dónde está el video representado de la verdad de un libre de sobrino?
hang on. They don't speak English, so I'm all right. I'm okay. You know, they're not going to find out.
just for your amusement there. So I'll probably get on some of the other questions as well. I know just recently, since we've got a 15. Yes. Yeah. A 15, which I was completely not expecting at all. How did you feel about that, you and Prano?
I think, to be honest, I can't speak for Prano. I don't know what she thought. We haven't really talked about it, to be honest. I suspect my thinking is, it's interesting. As a filmmaker, you want your films to be seen by as many people as possible. And I think especially, as you get to, Prano's quite a bit younger than me, but, you know, like, you want, this isn't a film to be seen by necessarily, I mean, I don't mind if studious, you know, people, men with beards, stroking their beards and smoking their pipes, you know, that's not, you know, that isn't, you know, like, it's a film which is supposed to make you think, which is supposed to make you, you know, question things, but it's also a film that's supposed to appeal to and hopefully does appeal to, you know, people of very different generations. And for me, that's exciting because, you know, so much of a lot of British filmmaking, to be honest, feels as though it slips into a niche where it's not going to appeal to very many people. It's not going to get beyond a very kind of narrow band. So, you know, to be honest, if it's a 15 and more people can watch it from younger people, I'm quite happy with that. I don't have a problem with that. That's cool.
You know. Me and my mates on Twitter who often browse the BBFC page a little too much than we need to when we should be working or take care of our families. We were putting bets on saying, I bet Sensa by Prano, who we refer to as PBB or Gold Raider because her surname is Bond. James.
Right.
we were betting an 18 on this one, hands down. But when we were like seeing it was a 15, we were a little bit upset about it. But then we thought, well, I guess if a film like Death Gasm or Hot Fuzz or Red Sparrow can get a 15, and those movies can get pretty violent and well, sexually charged, then this film can too, I guess. I'm,
definitely, yeah.
Because the meta nature of the narrative, because it's a film about a film censor being rated and sent classified by film examiners, it lends that sort of Kafka-esque what element about it.
Well, you almost think there's another film to be made about who was watching Censor and, you know, like, and how they judge that. But I don't think we'll make it. But, you know, like
well, we'll probably never know. But hopefully it's Craig Lapp because he's the guy who sounds like that. He probably would get a little bit of a kick out of it. Said, we can't give this an 18. Or probably she would send like a warrant for our arrest.
I mean, you know, to be fair, the BBFC... they were great. You know, they've always been really supportive of the project. So, you know, like I've got nothing but, you know, they were really lovely. I mean, when we first got in touch with them, I think we were a bit kind of like, oh, I'm not sure if they're going to like the idea of people going in and making a film about it. But they've been, you know, all the way along the line, they've been really supportive. And so, you know, they just which is great, which is really nice. You don't want to be having, you know, causing problems with, you know, on either sense.
Oh, no, I get that there. I mean, Oliver Stone had to do the same thing where he met these various names that he got for his research for his particular films, to where he probably had to alter the names or not mention a particular institution, probably to avoid legal issues and lawsuits. Like, in the film, you don't say BBFC or British Board
of Directors. No, we don't say BBFC.
The censor's office. Yeah. Was that for legal reasons? Did Film 4 say you could get sued?
No, but I think I don't think it was for that at all, actually. I think it was more just because we're it's a fiction, you know, it's not a documentary. And we wanted to move away from the idea that this is a documentary. You know, it's a fiction. It's not real characters, it's not a real story. You know, it has that relationship to the Office of Censorship, but it's a fictional world as well. I mean, it's in the 80s, but it's not a real, you know, like, you know, these characters don't exist. So, yeah, there was nothing legal about that. I think it was just a sort of creative decision on our part, to be honest.
Okay, then. That's what I was just curious about there. So I'll get to the next question in regards to perceived satire or social commentary. Because one of my mates caught that scene where I don't want to give spoilers. A person gets impaled by a particular item. He kind of chuckled that for unknown reasons. And it got me thinking for a second, because Prano did a short film called Man vs. Sand, which is very Chris Morris-esque. Has that sort of blue jam quality about it. And then, you know, the opening credits kind of reminded me a little bit of like a more fucked up version of Brass Eye. Was that intentional?
No, I wrote Man vs. Sand. That was a long time ago, and I wrote it. That was the first thing we did together, actually. There's a surreal edge to the work. You know, that again ties in perhaps with Cronenberg is the point of reference there. So, you'd have to ask her because the image itself, which you're referring to, you know, is very specific and very clear. I don't know exactly where she got that image from, but I couldn't say it comes from a specific, you know, reference point. You know.
Okay, then. I was just, you know, curious about it because I always pick up on sort of dark humor, wherever it is. I know recent years we had films like Get Out sort of play on issues of racism as a sort of trope for satirical purposes, but putting it in sort of a thriller horror narrative. And there were some moments here and there that was, in a way, like a more deadpan version of Chris Morris, but without...
Yeah, but I think it's really nice you mentioned Man vs. Sand, because that's a lovely little film, and it's a kind of quite... it has got that deadpan sort of British surrealist kind of thing, which Chris Morris had, and and that is a strand of the work that Prano does and we do together. You know, that kind of like slightly offbeat, you know, you're not quite sure what's going on sort of tone. But I think that's to be honest with you, that's something that personally I've always liked about, you know, if you look at someone like Lindsay Anderson, films like If and Oh Lucky Man, that sort of thing, you know, like there's a kind of quiet British surrealism which I've always really loved, and I think Prano does too, and so that kind of that is there. It's very understated, but it's there, and I think it's nice you picked that up.
Well, thank you. She's definitely one of great influences, even if she can't be here on board to talk about it. But I'm sure, you know, other interviews can probably explain her method of madness. So I will say on the next question as well, there are two influences of the film examiners that Enid works with. I don't know the names of them that well, but I know that man who says about King Lear, Enchant Andalou, and the guy that kind of looks a little like me.
Yeah.
And Danny Lee Winter's character. Well, I thought, hey, why did put someone that looks like me in the film? I don't know if that was intentional. Had to be your reference to two particular
things. Completely intentional. Completely intentional. What? Completely intentional. No, we knew exactly what you looked like, and we were waiting for this moment. So that no, Danny Lee Winter. Danny was cast. The casting always comes, you know, last thing. I mean, you know, we always knew he was the most sensitive and the kindest of the censors, and he always was. And he was the one who had a relationship that was slightly more heartfelt with Enid, and that was always the case. So but the actual casting and what he looked like came, you know, that you write the part and then they take it away and they give it to an actor. You don't have anything to, you know, that's a long way down the line.
So my mother was seeing it on another screen because I was watching the video on demand. I don't like telling people where I am located, but she thought, why are you in this film? And I said, I don't even know. She said the same thing when I was in the IT crowd. I'm Richard Iowade as well. But that's just for funny moments here and there. That was meant for her, no one else. But
I mean, it's a lovely performance by Danny, really, Danny Lee Winter. It gives it a tenderness, which is really helps because it's quite a tough office, and he gives her a sort of slightly different feel. So I think he captured the character really, really well, Perkins. You know, he got him to a T, really, and he captured that kind of slightly warm-hearted, you know, slightly kinder element. He got it really nicely. Yeah.
I will say also as well, I know you sometimes have certain characters and stuff in mind when you're writing, but between you and Prano, what particular part of things do you do? Is she more into the sort of horror theme elements and you're more into sort of the politics?
I don't know. I mean, to be honest, it's a good question. And, I would say in this film, when we came to write it, I always knew that, you know, the horror side, all of that, she would do a million times better than me. And, you know, like I do participate. We interchange, you know, I'll write something, I'll send it to her, she'll come to, so, you know, she, I imagine that the cliche would be that, and that I would be, but I mean, the truth of the matter is we share very much the process, I think, you know, like, you know, she will sometimes say, why don't you go and write this scene? And I'll say, why don't you go and write that scene? Which, you know, like the horror seems to be more her thing, and maybe the office scenes were slightly more. But, you know, the truth of the matter is, by the time it comes out in the wash, you don't even know who's written what on the wall.
All right, then. I was just curious about that, because when I saw your name, Anthony Fletcher, I thought, maybe you might be focused on some of the more sort of political sort of stuff, or that bit where the assistant censor says, King Lear. I'm Jean Andalou. I don't even get paid enough working here. I could be an academic. I thought.
Yeah, do you know what? I suspect that was Prano. I don't know. But again, it's one of those things where we just, you know, this stuff gets sort of batted back and forth. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I think it's completely right to say you don't know how many drafts this stuff goes through. It goes through drafts and drafts and drafts, goes through, you know, like at least 100 drafts. So by the time you get to draft 101, it doesn't matter who wrote what in draft 32, you know, it's just gone, you know.
Yeah, a bit exhausting there.
Yeah, no, it's a long old process, you know.
Well, hopefully we don't have too many questions for you. I will say the next one here for international audiences, because Censored came out, oddly enough, in the US and Canada first before it came out in Britain and Ireland, which is a little strange because they may not get some of the little commentary about BBFC and thatcherism. But, you know, America had Reagan. And they had the more majority, and don't take drugs, this is your brain. And MPAA, they banned, you know, censored a lot of stuff because it got an X, which in America is poison for box office. So what would you tell audiences who are from America or Australia, even France or Hungary?
I would tell them that if you are interested in firstly horror, secondly the process of watching a film and what that process is like set within a drama that is a family drama, essentially, because it's about a woman who is searching for her sister, but if that idea of a film which comments or examines what the process of watching a film is and what you can resist as a viewer, then I think without ever taking you to a place where you actually want to throw up, then you're going to really enjoy this film. That's what I'd say.
All right, then. That's definitely a good message for everyone out there, I'm sure.
Allez voir. Go and see it.
Oh, definitely. And also, do see it when it comes out in cinemas in the UK and Ireland on the 20th of August.
20th of August, yeah.
Don't let the 15th certificate fool you.
It is definitely a graphic title, but it's not human centipede. Don't get that out of your head.
No, that hasn't got... No.
And then also, on another note... So I am, from what I'm aware, you and Prano have a new project coming up, Things We Lost in the Fire, which is based on an Argentine novel. Was that ever your intention, or did you get commissioned by producers?
I don't know if you can see that. I'll hold it up there.
Las cosas que perdimos en el fuego, the things that we lost in the fire.
Mariana Enriquez. I don't know. I mean, we were definitely Prano is in conversation with various people about the next project, and one of those people and one of those projects is a company, a production company called RT Features, who have done a lot of very, very interesting cinema in the last 5-10 years, and I believe they hold the rights to the book, to the story. That we got in touch with them, we contacted them, Prano did, and they really keen on, they love Censor, so they're really keen on pushing forwards and trying to make that, you know, the next project. So like I said, Prano is in demand. She's got a lot of projects, but this is the next one we're going to write. So I believe that's coming up next, that we're going to write that. And it is a remarkable story. Mariana Enriquez, she was actually nominated for the International Booker Prize this year in the UK. And she's an amazing writer who kind of combines a kind of gothic, slightly horror sensibility with a political aspect to it. But also, you know, very entertaining, very compelling stories. So it's a really exciting project. It's a very, very exciting project.
Well, we honestly can't wait out for it. We wish you the best of luck for the project to move on forward. I know Prano's quite busy with all the latest things that she might be popping up, and we'll see how it goes. And I'll definitely do another interview with you when the things that we lost in the fire eventually comes out and gets played at festivals. I'll definitely be in the front lines for that one. Because when I first heard the premise, it definitely reminded me of like a weird mix between A Spit on Your Grave, MS-45, Nightingale, and Revenge, Corley Pagiat. It's French.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of that going on there.
A few years ago, that was very disturbing, very powerful.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, you know, there's issues like body horror. I mean, it's going to be a very arresting tale, you know, when the film comes out. Yeah, hopefully. We'll see. It won't come out for a couple of years because, with a bit of luck, it might get filmed next year and it would come out in 2023, I imagine, if that was the case.
So. Hopefully with the Delta variant, it will get up and running. Otherwise, we'll still have to keep waiting because of the cases of COVID rising up, which is why I had to wear a mask to force people to still wear it, even though Britain has legally said you don't have to. So this is to you, Boris.
Yeah, keep safe, everybody. I think that's the main thing. You know, make sure keep safe. Yeah.
The last question for the broadcast here: how would you feel if they made a remake of Censor, but they done it about the Twitter compliance department? And it was involving, Donald Trump tweeting out saying, go to this insurrection, storm the Capitol. And they made an America remake about it. And then she's being haunted by the ghosts of her right-wing past. That would be a terrible idea if they made a remake of Censor for about that in 30 years' time.
In 20 years' time, they need to do that now, don't they? I mean, they should get onto it straight away. I'd be very interested to see how they were going to make that, I don't know. I was thinking about a remake of Censor, whether that would be a viable or feasible, or if it's too British or not. And it's certainly an interesting question to see whether they could do that, whether it's something that somebody might want to do at some point. But anyway,
on the back of my head, like, oh, the Americans are going to somehow try to manipulate around this. And I thought maybe they could do about the Twitter compliance department, because they often take people.
But I think, to be honest with you, Mark, you're touching a really important point there. I think you mentioned this in your questions, where censorship today is, you know, prevalent in our life as an idea is very much with the use of social media and how that's how that's employed. So I mean, you know, these issues are around that are present. Is Trump censored? I don't think he is. He's just not allowed to use a platform. He's got there are other platforms he can use. You know, it's like he's not been censored. You know, so you know, it's not. So I don't think it's quite the same. But the issues around censorship seem to have gravitated, as almost all issues in modern life are, to social media and how we use those things.
I would agree with that too. Either, you know, from corporate ends, like you can't say about we're spilling gases and oil into the waters and letting the ducks and sea creatures die, or for that matter, government censorship, as we've seen over in Hong Kong and Hungary and so many places, just Tunisia, just a few days ago. And it's a pretty ugly picture what's going on right now. Even Brazil, neighboring up there with Bolsonaro, saying that COVID does not exist, it's a hoax, it's just a common cold.
Yeah, there's still talk about Bolsonaro. There was an interesting thing the other day that, you know, like yesterday I saw that, just on a slight side note, that, you know, the protests in Cuba, which were actually very small, you know, got so much attention, press attention in the West. And then yesterday there was enormous, massive protest against Bolsonaro. I mean, you know, I think the Brazilians have had enough of him. They want to get rid of him, and rightly so. And that doesn't get any coverage. So, you know, like, again, I think what you get more than you get censorship is like now you get who's controlling the media and who's controlling the medium and who's, oh, you know, what messages can get out and what messages can't. And that's, you know, that's, you know, I don't know. That's not so much people being censored. It's almost like people not finding their voice, which is a different thing. It's like, but anyway.
I totally agree with you there. It is definitely a really unsettling world to be in at this time with the pandemic and all the sort of vices people can make up at this time when no one's looking and everyone's thinking about Delta variant or if Britain lost the Euro 2020 championship and called the black players horrible words because they lost. Everyone's forgetting about all the other stuff that's going on right now.
Yeah, but that's the history of politics, you know. You make a it's Wag the Dog, you know. That's a great film there, which was made by, I don't know who made it, David, but Mamet wrote the script, I think. Barry Levinson, you know. I mean, it's nothing new, you know, and so that stuff's been going on all the time, but yeah, I mean, it's easy in a football phrase to take your eye off the ball and lose touch of what's really going on, what really matters, you know.
I think that's pretty much the entire message that I got from the censor film as well. Not only from my own little nerdiness surrounding, oh, they talk about BBFC ratings, oh, they mentioned a 15 or 18 certificate, because that definitely is the thing that, you know, got me all giddy, and everyone was looking at me like, what the hell are you talking about? They didn't get what I was coming at, but yeah, that's their problem, not mine. I'm sure if they made a US remake, but please don't call it censor, call it Hays Code, which is MPAA, where you
could
have pre-1968. But yeah, I hope the best of luck to you and Toronto, who I call. I expect you to die, Mr. Bond. Mrs. Bond. I don't know if she's a James Bond fan, but I just did that.
I don't know if she is or not, actually. I've got to be honest, but I'm not sure.
Well, whenever I do meet her and I'm you, I'll give you a virgin Bloody Mary. Shaken, not stirred.
Okay. All right. And, thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
I hope to see you in the next projects. Keep on coming and stay safe.
All right, and you too. All right. Thanks a lot, Mark.